glyphosate can have profound effects on human health at extremely low exposure levels.
The railroad prepares to begin spraying herbicide despite protests. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 2nd of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study shows diversity is the key to healthy and stable salmon populations.
We have very little technological management of the natural resources here. Mother Nature does a pretty good job taking care of them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
The Alaska Railroad plans to begin spraying herbicide along its tracks next week for the first time in 26 years. The permit was granted by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Environmental Health. The decision is being denounced by community health advocates, tribes, and municipalities along the tracks. Trustees for Alaska Attorney Austin Williams says DEC denied the railroad's pesticide permit requests in the past, partially because of concerns over water contamination.
However, this time, when the railroad submitted its application, it neglected to identify any of the waters along its railroad, failed to identify any of the vegetation or soil types that are along the right-of-way.
Williams says this rendered the application incomplete and made it impossible for the public to make an informed decision about whether to support or oppose spraying.
And the DEC's decision to issue the permit is arbitrary. Nothing has changed since this permit was last denied. The waters that existed over the last 28 years still exist. If anything, our understanding of the effects these chemicals can have on human health and the environment has improved, such that we should be even more wary of the chemicals today than we had been 30 years ago.
Trustees for Alaska has asked for an adjudicatory hearing with DEC and has requested Commissioner Larry Hartig to stay his decision on the permit until after that time. At issue is the chemical glyphosate. It's the active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup and also Aquamaster, which is the herbicide approved by DEC for the railroad to spray with. Pam Miller of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics says glyphosate poses a threat to water quality, fish habitat, berries, and other subsistence food.
Recent scientific evidence published in the peer-reviewed literature about these chemicals show that glyphosate can have profound effects on human health at extremely low exposure levels. And these include effects on reproduction, childhood development, immune and neurological function, as well as cancer risks, and especially two types of cancers, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and multiple myeloma.
But the DEC's Division of Environmental Health Director, Kristen Ryan, disagrees.
We've approved the use of a product where the active ingredient is glyphosate, which is a common household product in any herbicide most people use in their yards. It's been heavily tested, and it does not cause the health effects that they're claiming.
It comes down to dueling science, with both sides claiming they're using only legitimate peer-reviewed studies and suggesting the other side is not. Ryan says their science shows the herbicide is safe.
DEC issued a permit that was safe for the environment and public health. We know we've done a good job, and we know that the environment will be protected with what we issued.
ACAT's Pam Miller says new scientific studies are finding links to endocrine disruptors.
The many, many studies that are now being released, and this is really a revolution in science, looking at endocrine disorders at low dose effects. It's no longer a fact that the dose makes the poison. We know that these chemicals can affect our health at very, very low levels. And DEC is simply ignoring this current science.
Based on this information, the EPA is currently reviewing glyphosate, something Miller says hasn't been done since 1991. Alaska Railroad spokeswoman Stephanie Wheeler says they want to use the herbicide in addition to other methods, including hand clearing and mechanical brush cutters. The Federal Railroad Administration assesses fines to the Alaska Railroad yearly for failing to meet safety mandates because of the vegetation in and around the tracks. The permit becomes active next week on June 9th. ACATS Miller says they've asked for a decision from Commissioner Hartig by this Friday. She says if he does not stay the decision and allows the spray permit to proceed, ACAT will consider legal action in Superior Court. Salmon stocks and investment stocks may have a lot in common, according to a new study. Long term, the returns for both benefit from diversification. The cover article in tomorrow's issue of the journal Nature looks at the issue in Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. The researchers show diversification there helps maintain salmon runs at relatively stable levels year after year. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The University of Washington has been studying sockeye salmon in Bristol Bay for more than half a century. What they've found is a natural system that works remarkably well. In a year when certain rivers in the area have booming sockeye populations, others are bust. University of Washington researcher Daniel Schindler is also lead author of the Nature article. He says diversity is what makes the Bristol Bay fishery so dependable.
Bristol Bay, because it has this intact, diverse network of habitat and its associated diversity of salmon populations, is really reliable year after year.
The idea that diversification within a species is important isn't new, but Schindler says this study is one of the first to quantify just how important. He says it makes a big difference.
And we estimate that if Bristol Bay, for instance, had its habitat plowed under and turned into parking lots, and if salmon were produced in hatcheries rather than in wild systems, that we'd probably see fisheries closures every 2 to 3 years rather than once every few decades because of low returns.
The lower 48 is full of examples of rivers that have lost salmon diversity. Schindler says managers can increase hatchery production, but that won't maintain a stable population over time.
And for instance, in the Sacramento or even the Columbia River, you know, on average, they produce fair number of fish, but typically you get a couple total boom years, and then you get 2 or 3 years of total closures. So the year-to-year reliability of the system simply shuts down.
Schindler says Alaska isn't immune to increasing pressures to develop watersheds for things like hydropower or mineral extraction, but the state does have a choice, and that's unique.
So Alaska's really at a point where, you know, it's in a luxurious position of being able to say, do we want to maintain our habitat in the watersheds, or do we want to start developing them and with the risk of degrading their reliability, like much like the lower 48 has done?
Schindler says people fall into the trap of thinking it's easy to develop technological fixes to resource problems. He says it's a misguided and even arrogant approach.
In general, what we see is that the stocks do poorer and poorer as we pour more and more technology into them.
He says the best solution is also the easiest. Let the streams and rivers operate naturally. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The deadline passed last night for filing to run in this year's primary and general elections, with a dozen people from 4 different political parties entering the race for governor. 9 people are running for lieutenant governor, 6 for the U.S. Senate, and 4 for the U.S. House of Representatives. But legislative races are not so heavily contested. Of the 40 House and 10 Senate seats open, 16 races are uncontested, and voters will make decisions in both the primary and general elections in only 9 races around the state. Democrats have an advantage there with only 1 contested primary race. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak, faces no opposition to his return to the Capitol. He says the unusually low number of candidates could indicate that the public is reasonably happy with the direction the legislature is headed, and he says people are ready to pay less attention to politics.
After going through such a difficult presidential election last time that people may just be tired of politics, you know, and they're not unhappy with how things have gone in the state, I also think some folks are pretty pleased, at least at the fact that the Senate has been able to work as a bipartisan fashion and able to have accomplished what we wanted to accomplish and not have a lot of partisan political squabbling going on like you see in the Congress.
House Minority Leader Beth Curtula of Juneau doesn't have an opponent either. She says that she, too, has worried about the low number of candidates, but she says the ones who are running seem to be very qualified for the positions.
I think there still is a lot of interest in politics in Alaska, but it takes a lot to run. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to candidates and telling them the realities of it and encouraging people to run because it's a great experience. You really not only learn about your community and your state, you also learn a lot about what your own values are and where you stand on issues.
Stevens also points to economic uncertainty as a factor in the candidate turnout. He says people are concerned about the high costs of campaigning and the amount of money that the races at the top of the ballot will take away from what's available to the legislative races. He says at candidate fundraisers this year, he's seen fewer people in attendance than expected.
You know, I think people are just a little exhausted. I mean, I know personally, you get so many telephone calls and so many things from your party and from campaigns, and everyone is trying to build a campaign treasury, and I think folks are probably tired of the whole thing.
Sarah Palin has endorsed a challenger to Senator Lisa Murkowski in the Republican August primary. Palin today issued her support for Fairbanks lawyer Joe Miller on her Facebook page. The Miller and Murkowski campaigns did not have immediate comment. Palin says there's no bad blood between her and Murkowski, but she believes, quote, we need a bold reformer who is not afraid to stand up to special interests and take on the tough challenges of our time. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, mourning the loss of a whale in Southeast.
Well, it's part of science, but this is a real hard one because she's such a common whale for Sitka Sound. She's a fixture of Sitka Sound.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by the Center for Distance Education at University of Alaska Fairbanks, offering access to online courses from anywhere. Summer semester starts May 24th. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
The state is holding off on plans to kill wolves on the caribou calving grounds inside a national refuge on Unimak Island until it hears from a federal judge. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has said the Unimak mission could begin as early as yesterday, but Department of Law spokesman Bill McAllister says the hope now is to resolve the issue in court. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game wants to conduct aerial predator control on Unimak to remove wolves preying on caribou calves and help the herd make a comeback. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants more time to assess the situation and has threatened to consider state employees trespassers on the refuge if the state goes forward with its plan. The state is seeking a temporary restraining order. Researchers are heading into the Alaska Range this month as part of a National Science Foundation-funded project aimed at better understanding the emergence and growth of North America's biggest mountains. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The study is focused on the Denali Fault, which has produced major earthquakes, including a November 2002 7.9 shaker that rocked Alaska. Project developer, University of Alaska Fairbanks PhD geology student and mountaineer Jeff Benowitz says the goal is to identify and study the part of the fault where there's dramatic up and down or dip-slip action.
There's obviously huge mountains right next to the Denali Fault, which implies either dip slip on the Denali Fault itself or on faults associated with the Denali Fault.
Benowitz says there's evidence of a relatively recent extreme dip slip event north of Cantwell.
There's historical evidence of a huge landslide about 400 years ago that cross the valley and block the Nanana River.
Benowitz says the eastern part of the range is thought to have risen as much as 13 kilometers over millions of years, but most of the rock uplift has been eroded away. Benowitz is trying to document uplift by gathering rocks from areas along the active fault where there's upsurge, and he says it's sketchy work.
Knock off the rock, grab and run, because you're not necessarily in a safe place to grab a rock because it's an actually tectonic region.
The rocks are taken back to the laboratory where they're analyzed to determine age and rate of uplift. Benowitz's advisor, UAF geophysics professor Paul Layer, says understanding the Denali Fault could help better explain how mountains grow in general.
Do they grow kind of all at once, or are they growing gradually, or are they rising up sporadically? We know that mountains such as Denali are currently uplifting or growing in altitude. And what we want to do is understand that process over tens of millions of years and seeing how long it takes a mountain range to grow.
Layer says the challenge of Benowitz's project is teasing out how and when dramatic upsurge events occurred over geologic time along the Denali Fault. Benowitz says understanding the frequency and severity of such events could be useful in day-to-day applications, such as designing an Alaska gas pipeline to withstand up-and-down earthquake motion. The Denali Fault project is being collaborated on with researchers from the University of California at Davis and Syracuse University. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A whale that has lived in Sitka Sound for more than 25 years was found dead last week near Shelikof Bay. Experts say one or two whale deaths are reported every year in southeast Alaska. But as KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, this particular whale was well known to local biologists who are now trying to learn as much as they can about what happened.
Inside an office on Sitka's Japonski Island, research technician Jen Cedarleaf is on the phone, trying to piece together the last few moments of the whale's life.
Okay, we're just really curious because this is a whale that we've been seeing in Sitka Sound since 1984, so it's we're just trying to figure out what possibly could have happened to her. And we did get some photos that were sent to us taken on Friday, and she was all bloated.
The images also show the whale's fluke, its tail fin. Flukes carry patterns unique to each individual, sort of whale name tags, if you will. And this fluke is one that local biologists recognize.
We have a lot of information on her.
Whale biologist Jan Straley.
This whale we've seen in Sitka Sound since 1984, and almost every year since. I think we did not see her in 85 and 86, and I think 1999 we did not see her.
Straley says the whale was at least 5 years old when first spotted in 1984, so that made her at least 31 years old when she died. Whales have a lifespan roughly equal to humans. Blubber samples taken when the whale was alive show that she fed on herring, and she had been spotted here in the winter instead of migrating to Hawaii and back. One more thing about this whale, she had been given a name, Ika. Straley named the whale after her mother.
My mom's name is Ida, and Ika is Ida in Hawaiian. So she was a whale that ended up in a whale adoption program for a few years, and that was her name, and it's been her name ever since.
There's a trivet with Ika's fluke pattern hanging on Straley's wall. Straley says humpbacks are flourishing right now in the region, which means whale deaths will likely become more common as well.
Well, it's part of science, but this is a real hard one because she's such a common whale for Sitka Sound. She's a fixture of Sitka Sound.
So far, Straley's office has been able to determine that Ika was seen alive the afternoon of May 25th and then seen dead the next evening near Shelikof Bay by a crew aboard a fishing vessel. Straley says the photos, taken Friday by a charter vessel in the area, help fill in some blanks.
She doesn't look like she was entangled in anything. She's really clean that way. So the two possibilities are that she died a natural death or she was struck by something.
It's up to the National Marine Fisheries Service, a division of NOAA, to ultimately determine the whale's cause of death. Elyria Jensen works with the service's Protected Resources Division in Juneau. She says the carcass, originally spotted near Shelikof Bay, is believed to be drifting north. It was last seen on Friday.
If the animal were resighted, then we would certainly try to orchestrate a necropsy. The challenge with floaters like this, of course, is towing the animal to shore, so we could be constrained by weather and geography and personnel and having the right vessel, but we'll do all we can to make that happen.
Anyone who spots the whale is asked to report the sighting immediately to the Marine Mammal Stranding Hotline. It can be reached by calling 1-877-925-9925. 7773. In the meantime, Straley and her team will continue putting together as much information as they can, if only to complete the already long history of a familiar whale named Ika.
So Beaver Point is right at the mouth of Shelikov, is where she was first sighted, it sounds like.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
So she hasn't drifted that much.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
People who live around Quartz Lake north of Delta Junction have been notified about possible evacuation due to a growing wildfire. The Gills Creek Fire is burning nearby along the access road to the Pogo Mine. It's charred nearly 18,000 acres. A release from the team managing the fire response calls the pre-evacuation notice a level one action intended to give residents, especially those with special needs, pets, or livestock, time to prepare and pack up in case they have to move quickly in the near future. Extreme fire behavior has been reported on the Gills Creek blaze, which grew by 1,400 acres yesterday. The response has focused on protecting wooden pole-supported power lines that feed the Pogo Gold Mine. Southeast Alaska's largest Native cultural event begins this week in Juneau. As many as 2,000 dancers from Alaska, Canada, and the Lower 48 will take the stage to share song and dance traditions. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld previews two competitions that are part of Celebration 2010.
Black seaweed is a food tradition among the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people. It's collected at low tide and dried, sometimes with flavorings added.
Seaweed is now it's kind of a delicacy, but it used to be just a regular old food item.
Linda Bilardi of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is organizing Celebration 2010's traditional food contests. She says the mineral-rich seaweed has found its way into contemporary cooking.
People eat it as a snack. They a lot of times make it in a soup. And then nowadays people are cooking it with hamburger. They're cooking it with their chop suey. They're putting it in their scrambled egg omelets. So lots of different uses.
The contest compares standalone prepared seaweed. Bilardi says the judges are experts in taste testing. At an earlier event, she was surprised how much they could tell from a few bites.
The elders were saying, this one tastes like it has clam juice. And somebody else said, it tastes like they dried this one on the rocks. And I said, you can tell that from the taste? And they said, oh, yeah.
Celebration 2010's other traditional food contest is for soap berries, a small red fruit that tastes bitter before it's prepared. Bilardi remembers whipping them with hand mixers when she was young.
It isn't something that we had very often, and we would whip it up and add a little bit of sugar, sliced bananas, and then the eating of it is a social event because it makes a sound and you kind of plop, plop, plop it in your mouth.
Soap berries are not found everywhere. Bilardi says they're most often picked near Klukwan, Glacier Bay, and in parts of the interior. Celebration 2010 also includes an artist market, traditional storytelling, a juried art exhibition, and lectures on cultural and scientific topics. That's in addition to the dozens of dance performances scheduled for the three-day event. There's also a focus on language. The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute just released Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian Learners' Dictionaries, and they'll be highlighted during a language open house program. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Yupik storyteller John Active of Bethel is part of a new book on Trickster that features storytellers from all across the country. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
The book is titled Trickster, Native American Tales, a graphic collection. It's a colorful graphic novel that includes 21 stories illustrated in comic book style by 22 different artists.
The cartoon work is excellent.
John Active says he wrote his story for the book about a raven story that he learned from his grandmother, Maggie Lind. He said she would tell him stories about animals, including the trickster raven.
One day, Raven was walking along the Bering seashore. Whenever he came upon a duck, a sea anemone, he would give it a swift kick. So Raven continued down the beach, kicking a duck every time he came upon one. Punt! Oh, said the sea anemone.
The story continues on with Raven getting into several adventures where he tricks others into getting what he wants. The whole book is about the trickster character, which emerges in traditional stories in the form of different animals, including ravens, fox, coyotes, and rabbits. The book's editor, Matt Dembitsky, who lives in Virginia, worked on the book for 4 years. He says he came across John Active's name when he was researching storytellers from Alaska.
I wanted to work with the storytellers who would tell us their particular story base and their particular tribe and work with them to make sure that the rendition was the way they envisioned it, and to really kind of have them breathe the soul into the stories.
The book also features Alaska cartoonist Demi Macheris from Chicoloon, although he was paired up with a different storyteller. Dembitsky says he wanted to make sure the end product was something everyone felt good about, so he spent a lot of time working with the writers and artists.
I made sure there was a nice range of styles, from a cartoony style to more photorealistic style to a couple things in between. And I let the storyteller decide which artist they wanted to work with.
It's something that Active appreciated. He said he loved working with his cartoonist.
When he first started drawing the photos, the pictures, he thought the raven looked like a crow. I said, no. We'll send you a picture of a raven. So we did that. And then he tried to make the countryside in the background look like it was where, California or something. I said, no. It's flat. It's just flat country. It's tundra. And of course, I had to explain what tundra was to him, you know.
The book, Trickster Native American Tales, A Graphic Collection, is already on bookshelves at major bookstores as well as online. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.